Well, once again, good morning, everyone. Whoa. Gosh, you know, I just had that feeling this morning of rededication as I was, even as I was driving over here. You know, I'm so sorry that they're developing that corner right there at Antonio and Ortega, because that was one of my last respites. I get to drive down into that valley and just see that expanse of untouched hillside. So I'll have to learn to love tile roofs, I guess. I don't know, something like that. But yeah, just every morning coming out there and just looking eastward over those mountains and seeing the sun, it just is an amazing experience for me. And I hope you all have shared some of it this morning. But just the sense of at least getting down on one knee and just resubmitting to God, just allowing ourselves to feel that connection. But also what one of the monks who told me in Catholic high school, our creaturehood. I love that word, our creaturehood. We are creatures of God. Sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we want to be on a par with God. Sometimes we think we're in control of something. And we have to remember our creaturehood. So just being able to get small again, being able to realize we are the created, and the created has allowed us this immense and incredible opportunity to be one with the Creator. Wow. It's mind-blowing. Mind-blowing. Just like that sunrise this morning. So that's what we're doing here when we get together. I was talking to someone just a couple of days ago about her spiritual journey and where she was going. And she says, I don't have time to go to church. I can't because of my work schedule and this and that. And it's always on Sundays. I said, you know, that's fine. But let's separate religion from spirituality. You know, it is not about the going to the church. Going to church is wonderful. And in the group, it's so much easier for us to find this connection, to find this place where we can all say, yes, I believe and I understand how real this unseen God is. But it's not the be-all and end-all. It is not the spirituality itself. And all of those moments that we practice here together need to be then taken into every moment of your lives, into all the details. And so that's what we're doing. We're practicing here. This is practice for the rest of your week, okay? It doesn't just stop here. It doesn't start here. It continues here. So it's just great to see you all here this morning. We've been spending the last... it's getting to be 6 weeks now. This is the sixth installment of the book of James. And so we've been having a great time with James. At least I've been having a great time with James. I should say good. One other person is having a great time with James. As I've said over and over, but there's so many. I'm seeing new faces. Florencio, gosh, it's good to see you, buddy. There's new faces here. James is one of my favorite books of the New Testament, that along with the book of Matthew, and especially the Sermon on the Mount within the book of Matthew. They're both the most Jewish books of the Bible, and I think that's why I like them. They are concrete. They are practical. They are full of vivid imagery that just locks us into the concepts. And we're going to see that in spades this morning as we look at chapter 3. But just those two books alone, or just the Sermon on the Mount and the book of James, is the whole nut, the whole kernel of what it is that we're trying to do here. You want to understand Jesus' message? Understand the Sermon on the Mount. If you want to understand how that's applied to our lives, understand the book of James. They go hand in glove. And they're showing us how this thing works. They're showing us the how of this unity and this rededication and submission that we're talking about. And that's really the point of what's going on right here. Last week, we dealt with chapter 2, and we're kind of going a little bit out of order because the way that the topics kind of skip around in James, although we're going to look at chapter 3 all together now in this one session. Last week, we got to deal with probably the most famous part of James, which is the faith and works passage. That faith without works is dead. And to us, Westerners, always looking at things legally, that looks to us like we got some more rules to follow. There's more stuff that we got to do in order to be able to prove our faith or to have faith in the first place. And that is absolutely not the case. It's not what James is trying to get across. It's not what Jesus is trying to get across. We talked about the fact that God's Spirit is always in motion. You will never see God's Spirit portrayed in Scripture without it being in motion. The very word ruach in Hebrew, ruha in Aramaic, means breath, wind, and spirit all at the same time. It's as if God is breathing in and out. And the way we will experience His Spirit is always as a breath in and out, always in motion. If anything is dammed up, if anything is constipated, if anything is not flowing in your life, then you have somehow broken with this idea of Spirit. And that movement, if we hitch our wagon to God, if we are one with God, then we are in motion too, and there's no way that it can be other than that. And the works flow out of that motion. The works that we do are proof that we are hitched to God's wagon. And we're only hitched to God's wagon, we are only one with Him if we have the faith to overcome the fear, to take the risk, to hitch your wagon to God in motion. That's the way it works. And so there's this beautiful connection here that has nothing to do with rules. We've got to get this legal image out of our minds. It's not about rule following. It's about God following, in motion, moving through. And so this change, this radical shift in the way that we think has got to occur if we're going to understand what Jesus and James are really trying to get across to us. You know, and I was thinking as I was doing this message last week that many of you or several of you came up and said that that imagery really resonated. It connected with you, that idea of motion. And yet the next question is begged, how do we do that? You know, got to get practical. Got to really figure out, what do we do when we walk out that door? What do we do when we stand up and the music comes up? What can we physically choose and do that will move us in that direction? Start to hitch our wagon to God's motion. That's what I'm really concerned with. That's what I really want to see us getting deeper and deeper into. Just this last week, I think it was the last couple of weeks, one major celebrity had to be rushed to the hospital, and there was rumors that she was using some sort of drugs or substances or something, and it was kind of a big gossip scandal thing going on. And Marion and I were talking about it just yesterday, and it's like, is this the point at which she will be able to see that she needs a change in her life? Or will it just be that she's got so many resources that she'll just, you know, go to rehab, go to whatever she has to do, and then come right back to the old patterns? And does she have to hit bottom? How much does she have to lose? What is this point at which we finally decide that we want to change, that we want to move in a different direction, choose something other than we've always chosen that has gotten us where we are right now? The sixth step has a wonderful way of saying it. It says that we were entirely ready to let God change all these defects of character. And what does it mean to be entirely ready? How do you know when you're entirely ready? How do you know when you've hit the bottom? How do you know these things? You know, I'll tell you, it's very simple to me because I went skydiving once. How did I know that I was entirely ready to trust all these guys that for 8 hours on the ground told me I could survive this thing? How did I know that I was entirely ready to trust the guy who packed my chute? You know? How did I know that I wasn't going to freak out on the way down and forget to pull the cord? I don't know. How did I know? When I pushed off the darn plane and I started falling and I set in motion something that was going to end at the ground one way or another. That's when I was entirely ready. And that's when we know we're entirely ready to do anything. When we actually do it. Brings Yoda to mind. Remember that scene in one of the Star Wars? Luke is trying to lift the plane out of the swamp, and he says, well, I'll try. And Yoda, try not! And that little voice of his. Do or do not. There is no try. Try is what we say when we're giving ourselves excuses not to. There was a football movie on, one of these forgettable football movies, but one of these sections that just stuck in my mind was he said that what you have that the other team doesn't have is heart. I've seen it. You've shown it to me. If you take that heart out onto the field and you let it fly, you can't lose. At the end of the game, the other team might have more points than us. But if you play that way, you can't lose. And that's what this is about. Try not, do or do not, there is no try, doesn't mean we're always going to succeed at what the stated outcome is that we're after. But it means that we will play with abandon. It means that we will throw everything that we have into it and hold nothing back. And if we do that, we can't lose. The failures, quote unquote, of our lives will only be stepping stones to greater success. When James says that if we treat our difference, our difficulties as friends, those are the things that mature us, that's exactly what he's talking about here. All of this connects in James' message. I have a lot of counseling clients that I'm working with right now, and I'll tell you, a few of them lately have just been heartbreaking in terms of the stories of a person's childhood. Some of us have been so wounded, traumatized, betrayed as children. I just sit there and, you know, I want to scoop up that little seven-year-old inside because of what they've been through. And then it's no wonder why they're living in such fear today, why they're making the choices that they're making today. I mean, how could it be otherwise? If what was imprinted in you, what was shoved deep down into your spirit at such a young and tender age, was that you didn't matter, that nobody was really going to be there for you, that people were predators that you needed to somehow outmaneuver and outsmart. You know, these stories, these traumas become the basis of our choices, the basis of our addictions and all the obsessive compulsive things that we do out of fear, out of fear. The only way that we're going to be able to change that trajectory is when our desire to change becomes greater than our fear of risk. The desire has to become greater than the fear. And how does that happen? How do we do that? You know, we are so geared to think less of ourselves. We are so geared to feel that we aren't worthy, because that's usually the experience of most of our lives, isn't it? Just last week, last week, I think, we talked about the imagery, some of that great imagery in James, that he said, be doers and not just hearers of the word. He said, because if you just hear and you don't do, you're like a man who looks in the mirror and sees his reflection and then walks away and then forgets what he looks like. Isn't that a wonderful image? Well, Frank over here told me a story that a pastor that he was listening to, who was talking about that particular passage, interpreted it to mean that the man looks in the mirror and sees what a horrible, ugly, disgusting sinner he is, all the blemishes and all of the pockmarks and this horrible, disfigured face because of the state of sin and depravity that he's in. And then he goes away and thinks that that's not so somehow. I'm thinking, oh my. You know, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Sometimes an analogy is just an analogy. All this was a colorful way of showing that some of us here, things go in one ear and out the other, and they aren't retained. And where's the first place that we want to go is our legalistic thinkers. We want to go and say how horrible we are. You know, this Calvinist thinking, this idea of total depravity, that we are nothing, we are just scum on the bottom of God's shoe. And somehow, out of his grace, he allows us, he tolerates us somehow. This kind of thinking is so completely antithetical to what Jesus is trying to teach us and show us with his life. He is showing us that each one of us, in God's eyes, is a beautiful son or daughter, a cherished child, one that he wants to scoop up. But what if we're in the midst of sin? What if we are acting unlovely at the time? You know what? It doesn't matter. Think about the story of the prodigal son. The father doesn't care what the son has done. The father cares about one thing, that he came back. And even as he was coming back, before he had a chance to say he was sorry or make amends, before he even had time to clean off the pig excrement, his father had his arms around him and couldn't stop kissing his neck. That's the way God sees us. Legally, we think we are less than. Legally, we think we suffer. Legally, we think we have to do some works to prove our faith and to prove our worthiness to God. Relationally, it's a completely different story. And this is what James and Jesus are trying to get across. The fear that we feel, the fear that we have learned, makes us grasping, makes us envious, makes us angry, makes us frustrated. That fear is manifested in all those ways. Makes us codependent, feeling ugly, feeling unworthy, feeling like we can't change. So how are we going to overcome this fear? How are we going to change from a fear base to a love base? Raise that desire over our fear. The first thing we have to do is change the way that we think. And that's the value of these sessions, this time that we have together. It's only the first step. If we can talk about such things, if we can get a new thought in our heads, a new concept, gosh, maybe Jesus doesn't think I'm pond scum. If we can just get that first step, then we can make a choice based on that new concept that's different from the choice we made before. Then we will experience something different that will take us into the reality of the Father's love that can start breaking down the fear. This is where James is exactly leading us, I believe, in chapter 3. So let's read a little bit and see where he's going with this. James 3, 1 through 12. It's in your handouts if you want to follow along. I'm sure Aaron's gotten it up there. Let not many of you become teachers. Right away, I'm in trouble, right? Let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, knowing that as such we will incur a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. Now, if we put the bits into the horses' mouths so that they will obey us, we direct their entire body as well. Look at the ships also. Though they are so great and driven by strong winds, are still directed by a very small rudder, wherever the inclination of the pilot desires. So also the tongue is a small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things. See how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire. And the tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. The tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the entire body and sets on fire the course of our life and is set on fire by hell. For every species of beasts and birds, of reptiles and creatures of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by the human race, but no one can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil and full of deadly poison. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth comes both blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be this way. Does a fountain set out from the same opening both fresh and bitter water? Can a fig tree, my brethren, produce olives, or a vine produce figs? Nor can salt water produce fresh. So much in packed into those four little paragraphs. Think of the imagery that is there. I mean, this is just great writing. I don't know if any of you took creative writing classes, but this is wonderful, vivid imagery. I mean, the man in the mirror image that we've already talked about. But now we've got bits and horses and rudders on ships and forest fires and taming of beasts. All this really vivid imagery trying to get something across. And the tongue itself here is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for revealing what is actually written on our hearts. What is that thing that's written on our hearts, for better or for worse? The tongue reveals it. One thing that's a little difficult here because of the way it's translated is when he says that the tongue is the small member that defiles the entire body. The tongue really doesn't defile. It's a figure of speech. Remember what Jesus said at Matthew, whatever it was? Can't remember right now. The address escapes me. He said that it's not what goes into the mouth that defiles, it's what comes out. And he was talking in the context of the purity laws, the eating of kosher foods that were being so fastidiously held by the Pharisees. It's not what goes in, it's what comes out. Because what comes out is the sign of what's written on your heart. And the tongue is that sign. The tongue is that way that we understand what it is that's written on people's hearts. How do you know? How do you know what's written on a person's heart? How do you know what's in there? You know, you've got what they say, basically. There's this other idea here that I thought was really interesting, that the tongue boasts. We think of that as bragging. The tongue brags, and it's an idea of being conceited, being self-centered, and all that. But there's another sense of boast there that is actually what the idea that James is trying to get across to us, where he's driving at. And boast also means to possess. So like you say something like the school boasts a brand new stadium, The school possesses a brand new stadium. It could also mean to have or to contain. This room boasts a few hundred chairs, a few dozen chairs. So that idea of possessing, of having or containing is really what's going on here. The tongue boasts great things. The tongue possesses the power of influence that is completely disproportionate to its size. See where he's going with this? It's not about bragging. What can a tongue do? One man, one woman, one orator, with their tongue, with their words, can set afire an entire population. Great leaders have the ability to do that. The tongue has that power. Just like a single spark can start a wildfire, especially around here at high winds. That tiny, tiny spark. This is what James is trying to get across. For better, for worse, for good or for ill, the tongue has this power. Our words have power. We need to guard that power. We need to watch that power. Be careful of that power. Just like the bit turns the horse and the rudder turns the ship, the tongue has this ability to do this. And that's why teachers are held to a greater standard. Because we talk more than the rest of you combined, right? And what are we doing with these words? What are we doing with it? Are we being careful to make sure that the words are chosen well? This is what he's getting at here. Now, once again, if we think about this legally, it looks like James is trying to give us new rules, doesn't it? Oh my gosh, now I got to think about my tongue too. I got to think about every word that's coming out. I got to monitor my speech. I have to do all these things. And once again, this is not where he's going. Remember we said we don't have to do works to prove our faith? That's not the way it works. What we do is we hitch our wagon, we hitch our spirit to God's motion, and we can't help but do the works that the Father would do. It's the same thing here. He's not giving us new rules of how to speak, what to say, what not to say, as much as he's saying, when your heart is transformed from the inside out, when what is written on your heart looks like the law, looks like Jesus, then what comes out of your mouth is going to be a reflection of that. And the influence it has, disproportionate to its size, is going to be good. The ripples that come off of our lives are going to influence people in a positive way. Have you ever been shocked by a person that you thought was really evolved, that maybe you had up on a pedestal, and then in an unguarded moment you heard something come out of their mouth and you just went, what in the world was that all about? Shocking, isn't it? I had a brother, again, in Catholic high school, who told me that any man or woman, it was an all-guys school though, is capable of the utmost folly at any given moment. And that's absolutely true. James says we all stumble in so many ways. But when you think you know a person's character, it's shocking to hear something else come out. A few years ago, there was one of the most prominent reverends and televangelists in our country was on a plane, and he got into this altercation with the flight attendant over the fact that he couldn't hang his ministerial robes on the back of his first class seat, and that there were both grapes and cheese on his plate, and he was allergic to cheese, and he just went off the handle and shook the guy and just yelled at him and dressed him down. And that was a big deal, because we don't expect it from people who have a certain, you know, station in life. Our words have huge effects. What kind of damage does it do to the people around us when we lose it for just a moment? What the tongue does is reveal. It pulls back the curtain and reveals what is in there. Yeah, we all stumble. We all can't help it. But what James is saying is, this is a point for you to watch. You don't just follow rules about your tongue in order to, but the tongue is going to reveal to you what is inside. And if someone has to say to us, do you eat with that mouth? That's something for us to start to consider. Oh, yeah. Because sometimes we don't even realize what it is we're saying or the effect that it has on other people. And so This is what he's saying. This is a barometer for you. This is a way for you to start to zero in on what's going on inside, because sometimes it's really hard to know. And this is what we're doing. Out of this same mouth, out of this same tongue can come blessings and curses. And he says it shouldn't be. And he gives us this wonderful imagery of the fountain that only can produce either bitter or sweet water, but not both at the same time. A fig tree that produces figs and not olives. A vine that produces what it produces and not figs. And salt water that can only produce more salt water and not fresh. What are we? Salt water or fresh? Bitter or sweet? Olives or vines? What are we? We find out by what issues forth. And that gives us an idea about what it is that needs to change inside, that can stoke our desire to change inside, that eventually can outweigh the fear of change that we feel because of how we've been brought up. Jesus is telling us that you know the tree by your fruit. Same idea, trying to drive this idea home. If we don't know what someone else is about, if we don't know what we're about, look what the result is. Look at the effect. Look at what's going on. Only like can breed like. And this is one of the things that the church seemed to have missed for centuries. The churches seem to think that we can drive ourselves into the arms of a loving God through fear. If we just scare you enough, we can scare you straight. If we just scare you enough, you can realize how much you are loved, or at least come under the covering of that love, even if you still don't get it. But the problem is that fear only begets fear. Love begets love. Fear will never beget love. It can't do it. It doesn't work that way. Like begets like. I got an email a few weeks ago, and I thought this was fascinating. I just want to read you a few paragraphs of it because it comes from another tradition. It's an excerpt from The Last Ghost Dance by Brooke Medicine Eagle from American Native American tradition. And he's talking about the same sort of concepts, but in a different way that I think can help shed some light on what we're trying to say. He writes, "No sooner do we think about choosing this pathway of change than when we come to realize that it will take our attention and energy away from other things going on in our lives. And bottom line, it may cost time and effort and money. It means we're going to face all of our beliefs about security and about what we need to do to have life truly work for us." What a contrast with the prevailing notion, which looks perfectly reasonable since we all bought into it and play that game, that we dash about, work hard, make money, invest for the future, and so forth. To take time for silence, to focus attention on clearing our outmoded habits and patterns, to change our diet, to perhaps pay others for help in clearing our emotions and restoring physical health and energy, to spend time in nature regularly. These things mean a major shift in our priorities. We can't just take a pill and have all these things change automatically. The most important lesson in the entire process is that the method you use to transform yourself must have the same quality as the end you seek. I want to read that again. The most important lesson in the entire process is that the method you use to transform yourself must have the same quality as the end you seek. In other words, you can't dash wildly about to create peace in your life, although we've all tried that. If I can just get this and get this done, then I can sit down and have some quiet time. You know as well as I do it doesn't work that way. Instead, try stopping for a moment, taking a few deep breaths, intoning softly to yourself, "I am a peaceful person with plenty of time to accomplish all that needs to be done." This will create much more peace in the long run than frantic hurrying to complete all your tasks. Becoming what we want to create for the future is the challenge we have in every moment. He's echoing Gandhi there, who said, "Be the change you want to see in the world." Remember that one? What we wish to accomplish is to create quality in the process rather than thinking it only as an end product. This is what is meant by not lusting after outcomes. We must break the fearful cycle that pushes us to try to make things okay. Someone once told me something most helpful, that fear says, come to me and I will make you safe. While love simply says, you are safe. The difference? We must learn to proceed from trust rather than from anxiety. A good exercise is to examine any moment in your life and get down to what is motivating you. Simply notice how much you base every decision on some fear. Logical as it may seem, I need to go to work because I'm afraid I'll lose my job if I don't. If I lose my job, I'm afraid I won't get another easily. Good jobs are hard to come by. If I can't find another job, how will I take care of my family? I hear stories every day of middle-class people who have lost their homes and end up living in their cars. On and on it goes. Even if you can't suddenly leave your job and find your true calling, then change the way you think about your job. Question the fear motivations and practice transforming them in the moment. I'm going to work because I like to support my family. I can make a difference right where I am. As I bring my knowledge and skills and truth more fully into everyday life, I am moving toward more and more appropriate work. Opportunities to do what I would most like to do are opening up each day. I intend to have a fabulous day today, to feel good and do something good for others. The good news is that the inner experience comes first. This, in turn, is what eventually creates what happens externally. And so the question becomes, how do we create the inner experience, right? It keeps coming back to that. And here's our clue. Like breeds like. It means that we must have the same quality in the process as we're looking toward at the end. Marshall McLuhan said back in the 60s, the medium is the message. Your medium must be your message. Your means must have the same quality as your ends, because fear only breeds more fear. It's not going to take you to love. It's not going to take you across that divide. So you need to identify your motivation. What is it that's motivating you? If it's fear, that's where the thought process changes, so that you can change your actions, the choices that you make, and then you can see where they start to take you. I believe that James is exactly echoing this concept in this next passage. Read along. James 3:13. Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. And that doesn't have to do exactly with demons. It has to do with being devilish in nature, being adversarial, being contrary to God's unity. It's what he's talking about there. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. See what he's saying? He's saying that you can't work for peace, you can't work for unity, you can't work for love without first being peaceable, unified, and loving. The means must have the same quality as the ends. Like breeds like. The tongue reflects the inner heart. If the inner heart is bitter, how are we going to change that? We must have that same quality. And so, it sort of becomes a chicken and egg thing, doesn't it? A horse and cart thing. I mean, you can't work for unity until you're unified, but you have to work in order to be unified. I mean, how does that work? It's sort of like a catch-22. Remember the classic catch-22? It's about the World War II bomber who didn't want to run bombing missions anymore. He was afraid, so he thought if the Air Force declared him insane, then they would ground him. Trouble is, you'd have to be crazy to want to fly bombing missions and sane if you didn't. So as soon as you asked to stop, then you were declared sane and you had to. So here we are, trying to work for unity, but we've got to be unified first. But how do we work toward the unity in the first place then? And this is where James is trying to bring us. He's trying to bring us down to this understanding. The beauty of the good news is simply this. First of all, there is no bad news. God is exactly who Jesus says he is. But secondly, there's no catch-22. There's no requirements. God's love is always and freely available in this moment, every moment, to anyone and everyone at any time. All we have to do is immerse ourselves in that moment to find the unity that is already there. We don't have to understand it. There's nothing we have to do to earn it, to require it. All we have to do is just allow ourselves to be part of this moment. It's not about following rules. There are no rules to follow. It's immersion in a new experience. When we allow ourselves to have a new experience, that changes everything about the way that we look at life. It adds new information to our heads. When we move into the moment and we feel that connection and that well-being, it changes something in us. And we can continue to make new choices in a given direction, God's direction. I just had a conversation with a woman just this week, and it was great. She was talking about that she's been married just about a year, and she's been blending a family, you know. Her husband has had to blend with two children of hers from a previous marriage, and she's had to blend with his dog. He's got a black lab. The thing is huge. It's like a horse. And she is not particularly a dog person, she told me. And here she is with this big dog, and he's big, and he's smelly, and he sheds everywhere, and he brings dirt in and out. And on top of that, she's got this building resentment because she's a stay-at-home mom, and he works out of the home. And not only on top of that, he travels a lot. So who's looking after this dog? Who's picking up after this dog? Who's dealing with all the shedding and all the stuff? And it was really getting to be a huge issue for her. So what did she decide to do just this last week? She took the dog into the shower, got into the shower with him, and just washed him down. You know, gave him a really, really good scrubbing. And of course, the dog was just loving it. He was just, you know, oh, it was the greatest thing. But she washed the dog. He doesn't shed as much now. He's clean. He smells better. But something else happened as well. She found out she kind of enjoyed the experience with the dog. She bonded with the dog. She started to actually blend the family. Her feelings started to follow the choice that she made based on an idea that maybe this would be a good thing to clean up the dog so I don't have to put up with so much stuff. And now she's resolved to just do this every week. This dog is not going to leave her side. It's going to be following her around like a shadow, you know? Ah. And she's going to have fun in that shower with him, bathing him, being a part of him, feeling the coat, feeling the wet dog feel, getting sprayed when he shakes the water off, and being immersed in that experience of what it means to love an animal like that. She will become a dog person if she keeps this up. Watch out. This is what James is trying to bring us to. An understanding of, if we can move past our fears, if we can just for a moment, in the moment, make a different decision to do something that we would normally not do, to do something that normally repulses us or irritates us or annoys us, which are all manifestations of fear. If we can just break through and do something different, we will have an experience that is different, that will connect us in a way that we realize that this love of God is real. It's true. The promises are real and true. We don't have to worry about every little thing, because hitched to God's wagon in the motion of His Spirit, we will find these people and these new experiences that will make life beautiful, full of meaning and purpose. We need to start to act as if Certain things are already true. We need to choose as if what God says is true. We need to live our lives as if the only source of healing and salvation and wellness and unity and compassion and love is the moment that we're sitting in right now. And if we can choose as if, we will find out that's exactly the way that it is. And that experience will drive us to God's unity. And we'll break through the catch-22 and find out exactly what James and Jesus are talking about. Let's pray. As it seemed to want to say at the end of every one of these, if it were easy, I guess we'd all be doing it, Father. You know how we are made. You know exactly what we've been through. You've been with us every step of the way. You know our individual defects and failings and fears and traumas. Help us, moment by moment, and one by one, to break through, to become aware that we have a choice in each moment. We can choose other than we normally choose, that we can choose you, that we can choose to connect. We can do this. Help us to see each sunrise for what it is, a brand new opportunity to choose you, to hitch ourselves to your motion, to blow through life without a breeze because we're moving with the breeze, to feel that effortless motion that is your Spirit, Father. We long for this. Help our desire to grow beyond our fear of change so that we can choose you. And thank you for loving us the way that you do. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Let's all stand.